Okay, thank you very much. Well, first of all, hello everyone. So as Jorge just said, I'm definitely going to talk about quantum deformations of 4D spin flow models. So I'm going to communicate on some recent results obtained in collaboration with Katrin Neusberger in a paper that you can find on the archive at the address which is displayed in this first slide here. I also invite you to look into the paper by Munshin Han from Marseille where similar results were independently derived. So a word on today's talk. So I want to talk about these recent results, but I also want to try and spend a bit of time explaining the idea of how quantum groups come to play a role in spin flow models and how they relate to the cosmological constant. So there will be a bit of review in this talk. Maybe half of the talk will be some review to really try and motivate this strange idea. Why are we interested in quantum deformations? So on the next transparency, there's a short introduction in which I simply wanted to remind that spin flow models can at least be understood as a discretized functional integral for topological field series of a specific type, which are BF series, and via the interplay, the relationship between BF theory and gravity, these models play a role for quantum gravity. I should start saying that BF theory in 3 and 4 dimensions admits a formulation with a cosmological term. One can construct a volume term, as we will see, and include a cosmological constant in a theory. And models for theories where this cosmological constant is set to zero are usually based on the representation theory of Lie groups. And these models have a problem, which is that generally they diverge. They are defined by sums, which turn out to be infinite, and generally they do not converge. So one natural regularization, which is the one I'll be interested in today, consists in replacing the group with which one had started to define this model by the corresponding quantum group. And we'll see that this has the effect of, in all known example at least, making the models convergent, and also that this can be understood physically as switching on a cosmological constant in the theory, or at least in the context of topological theories. So our work with Katrin Neusberger here has been to apply this procedure to a specific model in 4 dimensions, which is the EPRL model. So on the next transparency, you'll find an outline of today's talk. So I'll start by the start, namely, where does this strange idea of considering quantum groups in the construction of spin forms has arisen, and this is in the context of gravity in free space-time dimensions. So we'll start there. And then we'll go one step closer to the theory of interest, namely obviously gravity in 4 dimensions, and we'll see how these results that we'll have obtained lift to 4 dimensions, but still remaining in the context of topological theories. And in the last part, we'll go to quantum gravity models and see how what we'll have learned in the two first parts can be used to try and make enhanced convergence properties of existing models. So next transparency, please, which is the start.
A quick question.
Yes.
So if I look at the three-dimensional models where the cosmological constant, where quantum deformation can be regarded as a cosmological constant. If I take the same idea to EPRL, does your regularization correspond to positive cosmological constants or negative in 4 dimensions?
Okay, so that's a very good question, of course. No, what we have done corresponds to a positive cosmological constant.
That's great. Thank you.
All right.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Okay. So on this first slide, so this is about gravity in 3D. So as I mentioned, this is interesting for us because this is where this idea of quantum deformations originally started. So obviously gravity in 3D is sort of a simplified framework where gravity is topological. There are no local degrees of freedom, and therefore it's an ideal testing ground for ideas and techniques that one would want to test before applying to 4D. So in this simplified context, the theory that we're interested in is first order gravity, which is based on two fundamental fields. The first one is the so-called coframe, which is a map from the tangent space of our space-time manifold over any point P into R3, the inertial space. And this is a local isomorphism which can be really understood as a gravitational field in the sense that it tells us how things compare between this curved manifold M and what happens in flat space. So the second field that we need is a connection which takes value in the Lie algebra of a given isometric group. So this Lie algebra or this group can be SO21 if we're interested in the Remsen gravity, or SO3 for Euclidean signature matrix. And we need to consider the curvature of this connection to build an action, which is noted F here, and I also use a symbol in these brackets for the killing form on the Lie algebra here. So these notations will be used throughout the talk. So the action for 3D gravity with cosmological constants is given by equation 1, so it's this integral of this 3 form that you have here. So there's the standard E wedge F term, and then there's a volume term that you can construct, and this is proportional to the cosmological constant. So this defines the dynamics of the theory, and one would like to have some insights on the quantum aspects of this theory, and one would want to try and compute, or at least make sense of the functional integral for this theory, which is noted Z here. So there is a context in which this can be done. This can be achieved by a regularization, and this regularization consists in discretizing the space-time manifold, that is triangulating it, chopping it up into tetrahedra, discretizing the fields, and obtaining a well-defined expression for this functional integral. And this can be achieved with most precision in the context of Euclidean gravity. So the group here is SO3, or its cover SU2, and for zero cosmological constant. And the corresponding model is called the Pontano-Regier model. So this model is defined in the next transparency. So it's a discretization of this quantity here. So it sort of falls in the general class of spinform models, which can be understood as a procedure to associate a number to any closed oriented triangulated three manifolds given a representation theory or representation category of a given group. So to construct this number, we need three pieces of data which are stated in this transparency. And for the Pontano-Regier model, these three pieces of data are the following. So first, we need an assignment of irreducible representations of SU2, so this is the representation theory we are considering for the specific model. So we assign spins to the edges of this triangulation or this triangulated manifold M. And the heuristics is that these spins are length quantum numbers for the edges to which they're associated. So once we associate such spins to edges, if one considers a triangle in this triangulated manifold, it's bounded by three edges. These three edges carry spins, and so a natural object to associate to this triangle is an intertwining operator between the three spins associated to the boundary of this triangle. So more precisely, one often uses the terminology state space. One associates a vector space of intertwiners to these triangles, which in a certain sense take into account the quantum geometry, the quantum states of this triangle. So the last piece of data we need is an amplitude for each tetrahedron, and this amplitude is a map that goes from the state spaces associated to the four triangles bounding this tetrahedron into the complex numbers. So for the Pontano-Regier model, this amplitude, once evaluated, is given by a 6J symbol. So with this data, we can construct a number for our triangulated space-time manifold, which is this number is given in equation 3. So it's given by associating certain weights to the edges of this triangulated manifold. These weights are the dimensions of the corresponding representations. and weights to the tetrahedra, which are given by 6J symbols, as we have just seen here. So one takes products over all these weights and then sums over all possible assignments of spins. So this sum obviously is infinite. This sum over I here in equation 3 is infinite. There is an infinite number of irreducible representations of SU2. And generally, that is for a large class of manifolds, this sum diverges. So this has been known for a while. There's a recent paper by Valentin Moser and Matthias Merlach where they study the structure of these divergences using cellular homology. But so the key thing is here that we would like to regularize this sum. So there are various ingredients, various procedures in the literature. One is to introduce a cutoff, which is what Pandanar and Rege originally did. Another one is due to the work by Laurent Fredel and David Louapre, which is to relate these divergences to some non-compact translational symmetry of the original action for 3D gravity, and therefore regularize this expression by a suitable gauge fixing procedure. And another way, which is the way that I'm interested in today, is to go to a Q-deformation of this model, and this leads us naturally to the so-called Turaeffiero model, which is explained in the next transparency. So the Turaeffiero model is a regularization of this Pandanar-Rege model, and the idea behind all this is very simple. The idea is that we have got here an infinite sum that causes these divergences. A very simple-minded way of getting rid of these divergences would be ideally to cut this infinite sum to a finite one. And this, if you look around, is something that can be achieved if one forgets about SU2 and considers instead the corresponding quantum group, so quantum SU2. And by this, I mean what is given by this notation UQ of SU2 here, the Q deformation of the enveloping algebra of SU2. So this is what I'll call quantum SU2, where it's a quantum group. And if you choose your deformation parameter to be a complex number at root of unity, you have got this very nice result that this quantum group admits only a finite number of irreducible representations. So this leads to a very natural idea. Suppose we consider the definition of the Pandanar-Rege model given in a previous slide, and we just simply replace SU2 by quantum SU2, more precisely the category of representations of SU2 with which we built the model by that of the representations of quantum SU2 at root of unity. If we did this, well, the model would be defined by construction by a finite sum and would therefore be by construction convergent. So that's the idea. It requires a bit of work, even a lot of work to actually be implemented, because I'm a bit cheating here in what I call the representations of UQ of SU2. There is some work to be done. These objects are not very well defined and not very suitable for standard manipulations, and so one has to work a bit on the representation theory of these quantum groups to lead it to something that one can work with. So this remarkably can be done by mathematicians. And so what I mean here by representations of UQSU2 is essentially what you get after this purification work. But forgetting about this, what we are led to is to consider a model where the assignments are now spins, as in a classical case, so spins that can take values 0, 1 half, 1. But the maximal value, so there is a maximal value here. So these spins are bounded by a quantity which depends on the deformation parameter. So this typically is exactly what we need to construct a convergent model. And this is what Turaev and Viro did. And they basically simply redid the Pandanar-Rege construction using a different group, namely UQSU2 at root of unity. So what they get is a finite partition function, which is given in equation 4. So typically, structurally, it's very similar to Pandanar and Rege. The weights for the edges are no longer dimensions, but two dimensions, which are the natural objects that replace dimensions when going from classical to quantum groups. and the weight for the tetrahedra are now quantum 6J symbols, which are 6J symbols for this representation theory. So there is a constant K here in equation 4 in front of the sum, which is here to ensure that this model is independent of the triangulation. So this constant K is chosen such that this model does not see any refinement of the triangulation. In other words, it's invariant under Packman moves, which makes it an invariant of topological manifolds. So this object classifies three-dimensional topological manifolds up to homeomorphisms, which makes it an extremely interesting object from the point of view of mathematics and low-dimensional topology. So up to now,
yes. Question, please. Does a constant K depend on the triangulation, or is it independent of the triangulation? Is it just a pure number?
Okay, great. Yes, it depends on the triangulation. So it's typically a certain quantity that has got as its exponent the number of vertices of the triangulation.
So it's K sub T or something in there?
Yes, you can see it that way exactly.
Thank you.
All right. So up to now, all we did is take Bandhanaregi and Q deformed it, but the deformation parameter here is completely arbitrary. So what's remarkable is that by tuning this deformation parameter appropriately, one can relate this Turiya zero model to gravity with now a positive cosmological constant, whereas Bandhanaregi was corresponding to gravity with zero cosmological constant. So this is explained in the next transparency. So there are, to my knowledge, two ways of understanding how Turiya zero is related to gravity with a cosmological constant. The first one uses the equivalence due to Witten between 2 plus 1 gravity for Euclidean signatures with positive cosmological constant and transfinement theory with group SU2 cross SU2 if the level of the transfinement theory is chosen to be a certain function of the cosmological constant. So using this equivalence on the one hand, and on the other hand, relations between different invariants of three manifolds, namely the Rishi-Titin-Turiya invariant and the square of the Turiya zero, one can obtain a relation of the type given in equation 5, namely that the Turiya zero model is a discretization of the functional integral for gravity, for Euclidean gravity with positive cosmological constant, if the deformation parameter is fixed to be the value given in equation 5, where LP is the Planck length in 3D, so GH bar, and LC is the cosmological length, that is 1 over square root of lambda. So that's the first way to relate Turiya zero to gravity with cosmological constant, and the second one is to look at the asymptotics of the amplitude for the tetrahedra, which is the quantum 6J symbol. So Mitsuguchi and Tada worked out an asymptotic formula by taking the spins to be very large, and they realized that the quantum 6J is asymptotic to a certain function of a quantity noted S of T here in equation 6, where ST is the Ricci action for the tetrahedron to which this quantum 6J is associated with cosmological constant. So this action is given in equation 7. So it's a standard Ricci action in terms of dihedral angles and lengths, and there is a volume part, a volume term, and which is proportional to the cosmological constant. So by these two ways, one realizes that the sort of seemingly ad hoc procedure of Q deforming simply to obtain a regularized version of Bandhanaregi has got, in fact, some very deep physical grounds. What we have effectively done is switched on as a cosmological constant. So now, obviously, one would like to do the same thing in four dimensions. This is explained in the next transparency. And so before going to full-fledged gravity, there is a natural step which consists in lifting what we've understood here to 4D, but remaining in the concepts of topological series. And this leads us to study BF theory. So as we will see, and as is widely known, BF theory in 4D is related to gravity by adding certain constraints to it. So what we're going to derive here will be a starting point for what will come when we will consider gravity. So let me remind you that BF theory on a four-dimensional manifold for a given semi-simple Lie group G is constructed by considering two fields, a two-form taking value in the Lie algebra of your group, and a connection on the principal boundary with group G, the structure with G over our manifold M. So this is really the generalization of the action that we had considered up to now for gravity in four dimensions. So using the same notations as before, one can construct an action out of these fields. And remarkably in 4D, one can also construct a volume term and therefore consider a formulation of the F theory with cosmological constants. And this action is given in equation 8, so it's standard BF part, and one can add a B squared term to it. And in front of this term is the cosmological constant. So we can ask the same question we asked before. Can we make sense of the functional integral of this theory? And again, the answer is yes in a certain case, which is in the next slide. And the case where it was originally done by Auguri is to consider the group to be SU2 and to put the cosmological constant to zero. So in that case, one can discretize the manifold, discretize the fields, compute this path integral, and one obtains a model, a spin film model, which is based on representation theory of SU2, because we're working with SU2 from the start. And this model is called the Auguri model. So the basic ingredients here are assignments of spins now to the triangles, no longer to the edges. This is because the B field is a 2-form now, and E was a 1-form in 3D. And therefore, if you've got spins associated to triangles, naturally, to tetrahedra, which are bounded by triangles, are associated intertwining operators, or vector spaces of intertwining operators. And now the last bit of information we need to construct the spin form is an amplitude for the higher dimensional simplices, which are now 4 simplexes, and these amplitudes are given by 15J symbols. So the model is defined by a partition function, which is given in equation 10, which resembles very much the Pantano-Reggie sum. The only notable difference is that there is a second sum here that you can see over this label J here, which comes from the fact that now we have, considering vector spaces of intertwiners, which are 4-valent, which are intertwining between 4 representations, and these vector spaces are no longer one-dimensional as we had in 3D, and so essentially this choice of labeling reduces to a choice of basis in this vector space. So again, same problem. For generic manifolds, this sum diverges, and in the next transparency, we can see how what we have learned studying Turaev-Viro can be useful here, and this leads us to the Crane-Yetter model. So again, same strategy. Change the representation theory you were using up to now by that of quantum SU2 with, again, the deformation parameter at root of unity. And by construction, you obtain, again, a finite model, which is given by equation 11, by associating, again, quantum dimensions as weights and quantum 15J symbols for the simplices. And again, fixing a constant in front of this sum k, which depends on the triangulation, which is tuned such that this model is 1, finite, but 2, invariant under 4D Pachmann rule, and therefore provides an invariance of topological 4 manifolds. So it should be stated that this invariant is weaker than the Turaev-Viro one, in the sense that it can be expressed solely in terms of quantities which are already well known from the topology of 4 manifolds, namely the Euler characteristic and the signature. So it's weaker, but nevertheless, it remains interesting, and it's also extremely interesting from the physics perspective, because using, again, the relationship to Chern-Simon theory, one can realize that using the relation between SU2BF theory with cosmological terms on the 4-manifold M and Chern-Simon theory on the boundary of this manifold, one can establish a relation given in equation 12, which tells us that the Crane-Yetter model is a discretization of the functional integral for BF theory with cosmological term if the deformation parameter is tuned such that it's given by the expression that you find in equation 12 here. So this sort of closes the aspects of topological theories, and this sort of closes the loop. We've got divergences. We cue deform to cure these divergences, and we then realize that this cue deformation consists in switching on a cosmological constant in the theory. So what about 4D gravity, which is what we're ultimately interested in? That can be found in the next slide. So let me simply remind you in a couple of lines the sort of starting point for the construction of spinform models now for 4D quantum gravity, which is that gravity can be obtained by putting specific constraints in the S theory. So the starting point is to look at the action for 3 plus 1 gravity with cosmological constants. So the fields now are still a coframe. It now takes value in R4, and the connection now takes value in SO31 for Lorentzian series or SO4 for Euclidean ones. So the action is given by equation 13. The only piece of structure I did not yet discuss is this star here. Star has got nothing to do with the Hodge operator on the cotangent space of the manifold. It has nothing to do with metrics. This is a so to speak, internal Hodge operator, which acts on the space of 2 forms over R4. So it's nothing to do with the metric here. So if you stare at this equation for a while, and you remember the action for the BF theory, you immediately realize that structurally, this is exactly a BF theory. You can rewrite this as a BF term plus a B squared term. I just put a sign here because the sign epsilon, because the Hodge squares to -1 for Lorentzian signatures and to 1 for Euclidean ones. But fixing this B to be of the form E wedge E, Hodge E wedge E, you obtain that structurally these actions are exactly the same. So this led, remarkably, Chlebanski to discover that this sort of simple-minded idea could be consistently implemented via a variational problem of an action. So Chlebanski wrote down an action in the context of self-dual gravity that was then extended by Fredel and Depipri to non-self-dual cases. And this action is given by equation 14. It's a BF action plus some constraints, quadratic constraints on the B field, which is noted C of B here. So this immediately leads us to a quantization strategy, which is the one underlying the construction of all 4D spinform models. Well, not all of them, but almost. And this is explained in the next transparency. So the idea here is that we would like to exploit this analogy between BF and gravity and try and use this to construct quantum gravity models. So the first such model was due to Barrett and Crane, came out some maybe 10 years ago. And recently, the so-called new models turned up, the EPRL and FK models, which are spinform models for Plebanski theory with 0 cosmological constants. And these models also incorporate a fixed external parameter, which is the inertia parameter that you find in the canonical theory. So the idea is what we were sort of mentioning here, to look at the path integral for BF theory, which we know can be written as the Auguri model, and implement some constraints on the data of the model, that is, at the level of the representation labels and intertwining operators. And we would like to implement constraints that would be related to the Plebanski constraints that transform BF theory into gravity. So this leads to the construction of these models, the latest ones, EPRL and FK type. These models satisfy a lot of very interesting properties. But there are some questions. The first one is, are the EPRL and FK models finite? The answer is no, probably not. Or let me rephrase it, we don't have any proof that these models are convergent. And it's actually widely spread that they are not convergent. So some of these divergences were studied by Perini, Rovelli, and Speciale in 2009. And I think this question is something that is an important point to try and address. The second question, how could we introduce a cosmological constant in these models? So there has been a recent proposal by the Marseille group, Gino Bianchi, Thomas Kraczewski, Carlo Rovelli, and Francesca Vidotto, where they, in the context of spinform cosmology, proposed an introduction, a way of introducing cosmological constants. But could we not try and somehow solve these two problems, answer these two questions at the same time? And in a certain sense, it's at least reasonable to believe that considering the quantum deformation of these models would definitely lead to a solution to the first question. Well, definitely it has to be proved, but I'll show you that this is the case. And maybe possibly, regarding what we have learned up to now, to also solve question number 2. So this idea has been that the cosmological constants would be related to Q deformations of classical groups has been around for a long time. Lee Smolin was the first one to come up with the idea in three plus one dimensions, and there was a lot of work with collaborators. And recently, the idea to apply these techniques to the EPLL-SK models was suggested in a review by Cal Ovelli recently. So this is what we have done. So our work is explained schematically in the next transparency. We have constructed and analyzed a Q deformation of the Euclidean and Lorentzian versions of the EPRL model. So that's what we have done. The main results that I'll show in a minute is that the two models, so for Euclidean signatures and Lorentzian signatures, are both finite. So let me schematically describe what we have done. So that for the Euclidean model, we constructed a spin form based on the representations of two copies of UQSU2 at root of unity, which means that the mathematics used here are very similar to the ones that appear in the Turalet-Giraud model. And the Lorentzian model is based on the so-called quantum Lorentz group, on representations of the quantum Lorentz group, which is constructed via the quantum double of UQ of SU2, but here with real deformation parameter, which makes a key difference. So this is sort of a standard construction in the theory of Hopf algebras, and when applied to quantum SU2 with Q real, produces a quantum group, which is the quantum Lorentz group.
Could I stop for a second? So in three dimensions, where you showed us about the theory of Euro model, etc., where we did the quantum deformation of SU2, and the whole discussion was only for the Euclidean case. So is there also, I mean, in light of your work or maybe some of previous work, understanding of the, in 2 plus 1 dimensions, of the Lorentzian sector with the cosmological constant and finiteness issue?
Right, yes, so that's a great question. So the answer is, to my knowledge, no. I mean, even in the classical case, so there has been some constructions of Pondano-Reggie for Lorentzian signatures, so models based on SO21. So you can construct these models, but then trying to regularize them would lead to consider models based on the quantum deformation of this SO21, and you consider quantum SU11, and this would lead to a model with seemingly positive cosmological constant but Lorentzian signatures, and this, to my knowledge, has not been considered. To my knowledge, the literature is empty on this subject, and it would be a great project, actually, to dive into, but I think that, for the moment, nothing has been done, and everything, all our knowledge in 3D is for Euclidean signatures.
Thank you.
Okay. So here in 4D, one can consider Euclidean and Lorentzian cases. So I'm going to describe the construction of this Q deformation. So to describe this, let me specify what are the essential ingredients that we need to construct this model. The first one is we need to understand the quantum analog of this subset of representations that are used in the EPRL model, which are called EPRL representations, which are selected such that they satisfy certain constraints which are related to the simplicity constraint, the Prebansky constraint. So this is the first thing we need to understand. And the second one is how to generalize to the quantum group case the specific intertwiners that are used in the EPRL model, that we call EPRL intertwiners. So we need to define these two objects to be able to construct the models. So let me stress, and from here on I will focus only on the Lorentzian sector, the reason being that the mathematics for quantum groups with Q root of unity and Q real are completely different. These are completely different mathematical objects. So these two cases need to be, in a certain sense, treated completely separately. So we'll focus on the most physically interesting one, which is the Lorentzian, and only state the result for the Euclidean at the end. So on the next transparency, we can start the construction of this two-deformed EPRL model. And the first ingredient that we need, as I was stating, is the so-called QEPRL representation, so the quantum analog of these specific representations that define the classical model. So for this, we need to understand a bit of representation theory of the quantum Lorentz group. And more precisely, what we need to understand is that the unitary irreducible representations of the principal series of the quantum Lorentz group have been, these representations have been firstly classified in the early 90s by Kutch and rediscovered and rederived by Buffonneau and Roche in their paper on harmonic analysis on the quantum Lorentz group. And these representations are labeled by two parameters. So the first one, n, is a half integer, possibly negative. And the second one is a real number, but which is bounded to be in the interval described in equation 15. So it's bounded from below and from above by a quantity which depends on the deformation parameter here. So this is in sharp contrast with the principal representations of the classical Lorentz group, where they're also labeled by two parameters n and p, but p is free to run over the entire real line. So this somehow compactification here for this label p will be the root of one of the convergences that will work out in this sequel. So now that we've understood this, we can try and derive what EPRL representations are. In the classical case, the EPRL construction can be understood as a procedure that, given a spin for SU2, which somehow encodes a spatial geometry, one would like to attach to this a representation of the Lorentz group, which should be somehow describing the geometry of space-time. So concretely, there is, in this construction, a lift from the representations of SU2 to those of the Lorentz group, which Lewis Crane calls the time functor, which I like as a name. And this lift can be generalized to the quantum group case. It's straightforward. It's given by this map phi of gamma here on the slide, which tells you that take a spin in the irreducibles of quantum SU2, and you can map them to a principal representation of the Lorentz group by putting this spin k in the first slot and putting gamma k in the second slot. So there is a key remark here, which is that if we want this second slot, this p, which is given by gamma k, to label a principal representation of the quantum Lorentz group, we need to put a restriction on these spins k. You see, so we need to restrict all the possible spins that we are considering to those which are bounded, as you can see under equation 16, by a certain value to make sure when you map this spin into these two slots, k and gamma k, we are still going to refer to a principal representation. So this is a key difference with the classical case. We need to impose this restriction. So note that this has nothing to do with the restriction that we had in the previous slides when we were studying quantum SU2 at root of unity. Here is quantum SU2 with real deformation parameter, which means that there are no restrictions on the spins, and the representation theory mimics very closely that of the classical SU2 group. So now we have the EPRL representations. We can try and construct the EPRL intertwiners. So this is explained in the next slide.
Okay, but at this stage, there is no restriction on gamma, is it? I mean, gamma could be bigger than 1 or smaller than 1. There's no...
Yes, exactly. There is not this restriction that you're referring to that appears in the Euclidean models,
okay,
where there is this restriction where somehow gamma has to be restricted to the rationals, and there are two models for gamma greater and smaller than 1. Here in the Lorentzian, we require it to be positive, and that's it.
Okay, thank you.
Right. So we've got the first ingredient for the construction of the model. We need the second one, which I remind you are the specific intertwiners, which are going to be associated to the tetrahedra of our triangulated manifold in the end. So how is this intertwiner constructed? So let me first introduce a bit of notation. I'm going to bundle up from here on these two parameters that label the principal representations n and p with a single symbol alpha. And the pi alpha are going to be the representations, and the v alphas are going to be the carrier spaces. So these are infinite dimensional vector spaces, or Hilbert spaces even. So given EPRL representation that we have just constructed has a nice property, which is actually a general property for all principal representations, to factorize in terms of representations of quantum SU2, as you can see in equation 17. So this factorization property is not specific to the EPRL representations. It happens for all principal representations. The fact that it's an EPRL representation simply tells us here that the lowest weight factor in this direct sum decomposition is given by this spin k that you can think of as related to the boundary, to the spatial part. So with this direct sum comes naturally a projection that maps you onto this lowest weight factor, and this is basically the ingredient that we are going to use to construct, as in the classical model, an embedding of the space of intertwiners for quantum SU2 into the space of intertwiners for the quantum Lorentz group. So this construction mimics very closely the classical one, so one can construct this embedding of vector spaces, and the EPRL intertwiner is then the image of any quantum SU2 intertwiner under this map F star. So in other words, to all quantum SU2 intertwiner noted lambda k here, this map associates an intertwiner for the quantum Lorentz group, which is, by definition, the quantum EPRL intertwiner. So concretely, it's defined by equation 18. So this map F star here is given by equation 18. And the only object that is lacking here is this quantity T alpha 1 to alpha n. So this I'll describe in the next slide. So just to read this equation, all we need to know is that this map here is a linear map from n copies of the alpha to itself, which commutes with the action of the quantum Lorentz group. So you can read this action, this equation as a map that goes from n copies of the alpha to itself. Then these n copies of the alpha are projected to n copies of vk, these lowest weights. And from here, using this Langer k intertwiner, you get a number. So this is a linear map from n copies of the alpha to c. So to be complete, I need to tell you what this T alpha 1 alpha n is. This is explained in the next slide. So this T alpha 1 to alpha n is the quantum analog of an expression that appears extremely often in the construction of intertwiners. It appears, for example, in the construction of Barrett Crane or in these new models. It's the Q analog of this key classical expression that one uses all the time, which is the integral using the Haar measure on any Lie group G of the tensor product of n representations. So this integral expression here is a linear map that goes from n copies of the alpha to itself and which commutes because of the invariances of the Haar measure with the action of the group you're considering. So it's crucial to generalize these constructions to the quantum group case to understand how this quantity can be generalized. So when you're considering quantum groups or more generally Hopf algebras, there is a notion of Haar measure, which is sort of the central ingredient that we need to generalize this quantity. This Haar measure is somewhat different than what we're used to in the sense that it's a completely algebraic object. So it's a linear Haar measure on the Hopf algebra H is a linear form on this algebra, which satisfies certain invariance properties that mimic closely the ones that we're used to when working with Haar measures for Lie groups. So what we need, and what actually can be defined to generalize this quantity, is a Haar measure on not the quantum Lorentz group, but if you wish, on the algebra of functions, so on the dual Hopf algebra to the quantum Lorentz group. So to make contact with what we're used to, there's this little example here where you take a function f on SL2C, and you can think of this map H, this Haar measure, as the object that was associated to f, the number obtained by integrating this function by using the Haar measure. So this is sort of to try and bridge what we are using here to what we're used to when doing harmonic analysis on groups, for instance. So using this Haar measure can be defined as an explicit formula for it in a particular basis of this Hopf algebra F2 of SL2C in the paper by Dufinoir and Roche. And using it, we can make sense of a quantity which generalizes this equation 19 and which is completely instrumental in the definition of the EPRL intertwiner. So this quantity, this generalization, is given by equation 20. So the things you recognize immediately are the tensor product of representation. So this behaves like in the classical case. And then there are some objects that I need to explain here. So there is this delta of n. So this delta of n is the gadget that you need to consider to construct tensor product of representations. When you're working with a Hopf algebra and you want to tensor n representations, you are going to use this gadget. And the convention is that delta of 2 is a standard code product, so the object that you use to tensor two representations. So this delta n here is this gadget, and there's a sum over the elements of a basis of the quantum Lorentz group, which is noted xA with A upstairs. And every time such a guy comes up in the sum, you put next to it an element of the dual basis of the dual Hopf algebra for FQ of itself to C, and you apply this Hall measure that we have just discussed onto this element here. To get this equation, obviously for this to make complete sense, you have to work your way through it and convince yourself that it definitely is the generalization of equation 19. But after a while, you get used to it, and this sort of closes the definition of the quantum PRL intertwiner. So it's given by the equation in the previous slide with T alpha 1 to alpha n now described. So remark. Yes?
About the Hahn measure itself. So in classical case, I mean, the Hahn measure has invariant properties. So I guess in the Hopf algebra, you translate the same invariant properties on this linear function, functional on the space of functions on the Hopf algebra, right?
Yes, exactly. So what defines, so by definition, a Hahn measure, so it's a linear form, so as we were discussing here, and it satisfies some invariance properties, exactly. So
then the classical case, these invariance properties basically define the Hahn measure uniquely, right? So is there a uniqueness statement here?
So in the case of the quantum Lorentz group, up to a normalization, there is a unique one which satisfies left and right invariance.
Right.
But for other Hopf algebras, namely, so for the finite dimensional ones, I think there's a uniqueness theorem. But for the non-finite dimensional ones, I'm not sure.
Okay. So looking at this Lorentz algebra, then this Hopf algebra, this Hahn measure is just normalized. Because that's not the case in the classical Hahn measure, because of the non-compactness of the group. Many of the divergences come because the measure is not normalizable. So in the quantum case, you're saying that the measure is normalizable. If I just take the function one on half algebra, what does the measure? What is H of X?
Yes, so we need to write this down, but my guess is that it's not normalized. So it's normalized for the UQSU2 part, but if I apply this on the identity on one, my guess is that I get something normalized.
Right. So therefore, this potential source of divergences, which was there in the classical case, is kind of there in the background in this case. Right? I mean, this T might not. I'm not clear that this intertwiner is always finite. Is that clear?
Exactly. So that's a key point which I was going to address here.
Let's go on then.
But as you say, exactly. We're working even in the classical model with non-compact groups here, and sort of what usually happens is that convergences are made better when going to Q deformation. But it's something that one has to check, as you mentioned.
Just go ahead.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So, as you say, is there any guarantee that what I just wrote down is finite? And the answer is yes, it is, but it has to be checked. And it's actually quite a lot of work, and this leads me naturally to discuss the properties of this EPRL intertwiner, which are described in the next transparency. So exactly, as you say, is this integral convergent, is the sort of quantum group equivalent of this classical integral convergent? And the answer is yes. Yes, it is. the precise statements. So what we did concretely is, so we fixed ourselves in the case of four valent intertwiners, although what I'd say generalizes, the finiteness results generalize, but this is what we have done as a first step. So the four valent intertwiners, which are the ones that we're going to use because we're working with triangulated manifolds here, when choosing a basis in this vector space given by four copies of the alpha and applying this EPRL intertwiner to this basis element, what you get is a multiple series. And the fact that it's a multiple series comes from the fact that this T alpha 1 alpha n that we've been just discussing here is given by a sum of the basis elements, and this sum is infinite. So it's not at all obvious that this thing does make sense. So you have to look at this multiple series and try and prove that it converges. So we proved that this evaluation here that I just wrote down, so this evaluation is a multiple series and it converges absolutely. So this is checked by looking at the explicit action of the quantum Lorentz group on these representation spaces V alpha, and by using certain asymptotics of some of the objects that come up in this action here. So you can prove that it's finite, which means that what we have just been discussing here makes sense. So the quantum EPRL intertwiner is well defined, which is a key thing that needed to be checked. So once this convergence is established, it's immediate to check by using the left and right invariants of the Haar measure that this linear map provides an intertwiner for the quantum Lorentz group. So it's up to now what we have been discussing is sort of makes sense. Now a second property that we checked is to look at how this object behaves under braiding. So let me remind you in a couple of words what the braiding is. So if you're working with a Lie group, and this Lie group has a representation on a given vector space V and on a given vector space W, you can construct the tensor product representation which acts on V tensor W. And the standard flip map that takes you from V tensor W to W tensor V, in the case of Lie groups, is an intertwining operator. Now, in the case of Hopf algebras, this is, in the general case, no longer true. And if you want to build an intertwiner between, in our case, going back to the quantum Lorentz group here, between a representation V alpha 1 tensor V alpha 2 and V alpha 2 tensor V alpha 1, you need an extra piece of structure, which is a gadget on your Hopf algebra, which is called an R matrix. So an R matrix, in the case of the quantum Lorentz group, sort of exists by construction because it's a quantum double. And using this gadget, you can construct this intertwiner between V alpha 1 tensor V alpha 2 and V alpha 2 tensor V alpha 1. And this intertwiner is called the braiding. Now, when you've got a braiding, a natural question when working with intertwiners for quantum groups is to understand if they're invariant or not under braiding, because somehow this later on is going to have some impact on whether or not things depend on crossings or not when we're going to use some diagrams to define some amplitudes. And the result here is that the quantum EPRL intertwiner is not invariant under braiding. So this is sort of a mathematical property of the model. It comes essentially from the fact that we're not working with the type of representations that were used in the old model, in the Barrett-Crane model, which was the simple representations. Because in that case, in the old model, Nui and Roche had constructed the quantum deformation of Barrett-Crane, and their intertwiner was invariant under braiding. So the fact that we're using these different representations here have an impact, and this object is not invariant under this transformation. So this sort of closes the definition of the EPRL intertwiner, and the last bit of information that we need to construct our model is an amplitude for the four simplexes. So this is defined as the next transparency. So I see that I'm getting a bit maybe short on time, so maybe the next two transparencies, I'm going to fly maybe over them. So the message here, essentially what I wanted to discuss here is that we need to define an amplitude for the four simplexes. So what is going to happen is that we're going to associate EPRL intertwiners to tetrahedra of a given four simplex, which means that when we're going to have two tetrahedra glued together along a common triangle, we're going to have to find a way of pairing these equivalent equinas. And a very natural way of keeping track of the combinatorics of these pairings that would occur for intertwiners associated to tetrahedra in a given four simplexes is captured using a graphical calculus, which is that of spin networks. So what we did is we derived a graphical calculus, the ingredients of which you can find on this transparency here. So we use a graphical representation of the EPRL intertwiners. So more precisely, we look at duals of these objects. And this comes from the fact that we're working with infinite dimensional representations. So we've got no structure to pair the EPRL intertwiners in the way that I've defined them up to now. So we basically dualize this. So instead of considering linear maps from, say, n copies of the alpha to C, we consider linear maps from C to n copies of the alpha, which is equivalent to considering tensors that live in say, n copies of the alpha. So we sort of dualize these objects. We call these guys EPRL tensors. They are depicted by a vertex with four lines emerging, as you can see. So this diagram is read from bottom to top. And once we have got this diagrammatics for the EPRL tensors, we can now pair them. And the pairing occurs with a bilinear form that we have calculated for it to satisfy certain invariance properties. And using this bilinear form, we can now start pairing together different EPRL tensors by simply putting this diagram on the top and connecting the different lines. So we've got a way of pairing them. And the point is that if you start pairing more than two lines together with this bilinear form, you could create some crossings. And so the crossings in the diagram are correspond algebraically to this grading map that we've been considering up to now. So in the next transparency, I sort of continue explaining this idea where we can use these bilinear forms to pair together EPRL tensors. And we derive a procedure to associate a number to all closed diagrams. So this procedure is a bit involved because, as in the classical case, there are some divergences that need to be regularized. But sort of the main message here that I'd like to bring through is that so that we define this procedure that associates a number to all closed diagrams. And this number could be infinite. But the diagram that interests us the most is a diagram given by equation 24. This diagram is the one that encodes, as we were mentioning, the combinatorics of the pairing of EPRL intertwiners or tensors inside a given four simplex. And one of our main results is that this procedure to extract a number out of this diagram gives you a multiple series. You've got no reason to believe that they'll converge, but in this case, it converges absolutely. So this diagram, which defines the amplitude for the four simplexes, is a well-defined quantity. So in the next transparency, I sort of summarize the construction of the model. I'll be very quick here. So we consider a closed oriented triangulated four manifold. We associate EPRL representations to the triangles of this manifold. We associate these dual objects, the EPRL tensors, to the tetrahedra of this manifold. And for the four simplexes, we associate an amplitude which is defined by our evaluation procedure applied to this diagram gamma 5 that we had on the previous slide. And we proved that this was a finite number, finite complex number. So the partition function that defines the model is given by equation 25. We've got weights for the triangles, which are two dimensions, weight for the four simplexes, which I have just defined, and the sums are over SU2 spins, which are finite by construction. There's only a finite number of terms in these sums, because when we constructed the model, remember this map phi gamma, we restricted the spins of the QSU2 that we used to construct the model for consistency requirements. So this partition function is finite. So in the next transparency, I conclude. Let me summarize what we have done. We constructed and analyzed a Q deformation of the EPRL model. So we generalize the classical constructions to models based on two copies of UQSU2 at root of unity for the Euclidean model and the quantum double of UQSU2 with Q real for the Lorentzian model. We define the UPRL intertwiner, proved that it converged, and studied its properties under braiding. And then we constructed an amplitude for the four simplexes and proved its convergence. And we obtained a partition function, which is finite for both Euclidean and Lorentzian signatures. Now, the open question is there a relationship to the cosmological constant? So is this a model of quantum gravity in the De Sitter space? I don't know. It would be obviously great. So there are some hints that this is the case. The hints are that all that we have learned in the two first part of the talk concerning relationships between two deformations and the cosmological constant, a second hint is obtained by fixing our deformation parameter for the Lorentzian model to be a specific exponential of the ratio here that's given above equation 26. If we fix the deformation parameter to be of that form, we obtain a bound on the area of the triangle. So namely, EPRL construction gives a formula to calculate the area of the triangles, which matches the loop quantum gravity spectrum. And this area here is bounded from above by something that depends on the cosmological length. So that's sort of another hint that there is a relation to the cosmological constant. But these are sort of, this is no global proof. We need some more work to be able to establish this correspondence. And for instance, what would be great to do is to calculate the asymptotics of this model, or at least to look at the asymptotics of the amplitude for the four simplexes. There's a very recent paper by Yu-Ding and Munxin Han in Marseille where they start developing some asymptotic tools to tackle this issue. But this is ongoing work that would need to be pursued to see if we would be able, in the asymptotic formula, to find a volume term for the four simplex with the cosmological constant in front. So I'll stop here and thank you for your attention.
Questions?
So what happens to the boundary Hilbert space in this case? How does that change? Is there any idea?
Yes, good question. Well, if we look at the boundary Hilbert space, we would have a Hilbert space of quantum spin networks, but with quantum spin networks for EQSU2 with Q real, so not root of unity.
Okay.
But it would look like something like that. Yes, definitely.
Okay, thanks.
So I have a couple of questions. The first is, one can look at this whole idea of quantum deformations, both in three and four dimensions, at different levels. One level could be to say that, well, we really are, I mean, the real world, it is really just classical groups, SU2 or Lorentz group, etc. And I write down some functional integral, I find that there is infrared divergence, and one way to cure infrared divergence is to really switch on a small cosmological constant. And I can, you know, so it's just a computational tool, so to say. And maybe I can actually calculate these amplitudes and then maybe take some limits or do something. So the first idea is that it is really just not a physical thing at all, it is just a computational tool. The second idea might be the other extreme, which is to say that no, fundamentally everything is really quantum groups, and that so far we had done everything with classical groups, and that was just a kind of a first go at it. And what you really think about even the connections and so on as not taking values in the classical groups, but the quantum group valued connections. And I think the second one, in the early days at least, didn't really make any sense, even with the things like the looking at, you know, taking the edges and making them slightly thicker and so on, making them into ribbons and so on. It didn't really make any sense. But till then, people in Warsaw, Okola in particular, has worked on quantum connections. So my question to you, who has thought about all these issues, is the following. which of these two extreme points of views do you sympathize with? And is there an in-between point, perhaps, that you like? So what is your viewpoint about this quantum deformation?
Right. Well, it's definitely a key question. So where does one place himself between these two extremes? So I would say a bit in between. Because you see, so what we have learned here is that we could regularize things by using quantum groups, and that there are some hints that these are related to the cosmological constant. These are actually very, very strong hints in the case of topological theories. But the arguments relating these two things, quantum deformation and cosmological constant, are rather indirect, right? I mean, there is no direct proof that Q deformation equals cosmological constant. So I'm not saying it's not convincing, but it's not direct. And it's what I've got in mind is that this is in sharp contrast with people who do combinatorial quantization of Chern-Simons theory, for example, in 2 plus 1 gravity, where they realize that really the only structure that makes their theory work is quantum groups, that they have to work with states that are invariant under some so-called quantum symmetries, and these are governed completely by quantum groups. So these people in this combinatorial quantization program, I mean, quantum groups appear in a not only natural but tremendous way. Hello? Hello?
Yes, we're here.
Hello? Yes, some sort of bug here.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Yes, okay, sorry. Yes, so we are not in this situation here. So I know, for example, that people like Karim Nui and Eno and Philippe Roche and Biffenois, when they looked at the canonical analysis of Plevansky's theory, one thing that they were really interested in would be, are we going to find some quantum group structures in this analysis in the same way that they show up when doing similar computations into Dasein gravity? And their answer was no. So it seems that these quantum groups do not appear in a way which is as strong as in 2 plus 1 gravity. And this is reflected here because this proof between relations between quantum deformation and cosmological constant here, I mean, it's definitely proof for topological theories. But when we switch on the gravitational interaction, it becomes much more conjectural. So to answer your question, personally, I would place myself a bit in between these two radical points of view.
Okay, so, I mean, if you look at your amplitude, for example, and you have to find that again, then in that case, would you actually be able to find the limit? Q going to zero at the end of the calculation. You obtain a finite transition amplitude, but then you can limit at the end. Or will that limit clearly diverge what the correct infinities that we know are there?
Right. I'm sorry. I've got trouble. There's a sort of echo that's sort of polluting when I speak and when I listen. So,
is it only me? Has their mic on? Can everybody else other than the speaker switch off their mics, please?
Okay. That sounds better.
So can you repeat the question, Abhay?
Yes.
So the question is, at the end of the calculation, you could take a limit, Q going to zero, and still hope to obtain a finite answer, or is your current understanding that there's a limit, all the current divergence will reappear.
Okay, so the echo is still here, but at least I think I managed to grasp the question this time. So yes, the various levels. So we could look at the limit when Q goes to 1 at the level of the entropy for the four simplexes. That's something we could do, and we haven't checked it, but I'm convinced that we would recover the classical amplitude for the four simplexes. So that wouldn't change. This amplitude, even in the classical case, has been proven to be finite. So the amplitude for one four simplex with six boundary spins is finite. Even in a classical case.
Right.
It becomes the divergences come when we sum over all the spins at the end of the day in this Cartesian function. And there, if we took Q to 1, the sum would become infinite again, and we would be back into the infinite divergences of the classical model.
So we cannot afford to take. Regulated as can be taken away at the end of the day. You have to regard it as something as fundamental.
Yeah, again, I'm sorry, it's still polluted and I had trouble grasping it.
Okay, so I'm done because I think it's difficult to communicate.
Okay.
More questions? Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Winston again.
Thank you very much.
Winston, I will call you to continue the discussion.
Oh, great. Okay. Yes.